National Public Radio, in association with Independent Radio Drama Productions, presents one of the cases of Sherlock Holmes, with Edward Petherbridge as Sherlock Holmes and David Peart as Dr. John H. Watson. This is episode one of A Scandal in Bohemia. There was a phenomenon on London's newsstands in 1891. It was called the Strand Magazine. Britain had never before seen a publication like it, offering photographs on almost every page. It was loaded with adventure stories, inside scoops on the lives of the rich and notorious, and interviews with famous people. More than 300,000 copies were sold in the first month the Strand was on the stand, an unprecedented event in British magazine publishing. The Strand was unabashedly populist in outlook. Its editors believed that a new literary art should be encouraged. Instead of the serial novel, which was then popular, the Strand would present a series of short stories, each complete, but utilizing a continuing cast of characters. It was to this new, innovative, and immensely popular magazine that a young writer named Arthur Conan Doyle sent a humorous story about a phonograph. When it was accepted, he decided to offer the magazine a series of six short stories featuring a character he had already introduced in two novels. The editors agreed, and in 2 weeks' time, Conan Doyle wrote two Sherlock Holmes short stories. The first was A Scandal in Bohemia. The instant this story appeared in the July number of The Strand, Holmes blazed into popularity. The Strand editors, knowing a winner when they saw one, asked Conan Doyle to write more than the six Holmes adventures. He refused. He had already plotted a historical novel and was anxious to begin it. But the Strand editors kept pestering him. Finally, Conan Doyle agreed, but set a price per story so high that he was certain the magazine would refuse to pay it. The editors immediately agreed to Conan Doyle's terms, and thus were written the short stories that would be later gathered into the anthology known as The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes. Here is the short story that began it all, as we hear Edward Petherbridge as Sherlock Holmes and David Peart as Dr. John H. Watson in episode one of A Scandal in Bohemia.
To Sherlock Holmes, she was always the woman. I have seldom heard him mention her under any other name. In his eyes, she eclipses and predominates the whole of her sex. It was not that he felt any emotion akin to love for Irene Adler. All emotions, and that one particularly, were abhorrent to his cold, precise, but admirably balanced mind. He was the most perfect reasoning and observing machine that the world has ever seen. But as a lover, he would have placed himself in a false position. He never spoke of the softer passions, save with a jibe and a sneer. They were admirable things for the observer, excellent for drawing the veil from men's motives and actions. But for the trained reasoner to admit such intrusions into his own delicate and finely adjusted temperament was to introduce a distracting factor, which might throw a doubt upon all his mental results. Grit in a sensitive instrument or a crack in one of his own high-power lenses would not be more disturbing than a strong emotion in a nature such as his. And yet, there was but one woman to him, and that woman was the late Irene Adler. I had seen little of Holmes lately. My marriage had drifted us away from each other. My own complete happiness was sufficient to absorb all my attention, while Holmes, who loathed every form of society with his whole bohemian soul, remained in our lodgings in Baker Street, buried among his old books, and alternating from week to week between cocaine and ambition, the drowsiness of the drug, and the fierce energy of his own keen nature. He was still, as ever, deeply attracted by the study of crime, and occupied his extraordinary powers in clearing up those mysteries which had been abandoned as hopeless by the official police. From time to time I heard some vague account of his doings, his summons to Odessa in the case of the Trepoff murder, of his clearing up the singular tragedy of the Atkinson brothers in Trincomalee, and finally, of the mission which he had accomplished so delicately for the reigning family of Holland. Beyond these signs of his activity, which I merely shared with all the readers of the daily press, I knew little of my former friend and companion. One night, it was on the 20th of March, 1888, I was returning from a journey to a patient when my way led me through Baker Street. As I passed the well-remembered door, which must always be associated in my mind with the dark incidents of the study in Scarlet, I was seized with a keen desire to see Holmes again.
There has been a murder done, and the murderer was a man. A study in Scarlet, eh? Why shouldn't we use a little art jargon? There's the scarlet thread of murder running through the colorless skein of life.
The secretary, Mr. Joseph Stangerson, has been murdered.
Gentlemen, let me introduce you to Mr. Jefferson Hope, the murderer of Enoch Trevor.
If there's a place for a chief of police, I reckon you are the man for it.
I knew of their guilt, though, and I determined that I should be judge, jury, and executioner all rolled into one. You'd have done the same if you had any humanity, if you'd have been in my place.
His rooms were brilliantly lit, and even as I looked up, I saw his tall, spare figure pass twice in a dark silhouette against the blind. He was pacing the room swiftly, eagerly, with his head sunk upon his chest and his hands clasped behind him. He was at work again. He had risen out of his drug-created dreams and was hot upon the scent of some new problem. I rang the bell.
Ah, what?
I just happened to be passing and thought I'd...
Cigar?
Oh, well, I...
Wedlock suits you. I think, Watson, that you've put on 7.5 pounds since I last saw you.
7?
Indeed, I would have thought a little more. Just a trifle more, I fancy, Watson. And in practice again, I observed. You did not tell me that you intended to go into harness.
Then how do you know?
I see it. I deduce it. How do I know that you have been getting yourself very wet lately and that you have a most clumsy and careless servant girl?
My dear Holmes, this is too much. You would certainly have been burned had you lived a few centuries ago. It is true that I had a country walk on Thursday and came home in a dreadful mess. But as I have changed my clothes, I can't imagine how you deduced it. As to Mary Jane, she is incorrigible, and my wife has given her notice. But there again, I fail to see how you work it out.
It is simplicity itself. My eyes tell me that on the inside of your left shoe, just where the firelight strikes it, the leather is scored by 6 almost parallel cuts. Obviously, they have been caused by someone who has very carelessly scraped round the edges of the sole in order to remove crusted mud from it. Hence, you see my double deduction that you had been out in vile weather and that you had a particularly malignant boot-slitting specimen of the London slavey. As to your practice, if a gentleman walks into my room smelling of iodoform with a black mark of nitrate of silver upon his right forefinger and a bulge on the right side of his top hat to show where he has secreted his stethoscope, I must be done indeed if I do not pronounce him to be an active member of the medical profession.
I am always baffled until you explain your process. And yet I believe that my eyes are as good as yours.
Quite so. You see that you do not observe. The distinction is clear. For example, you have frequently seen the steps which lead up from the hall to this room.
Frequently?
How often?
Oh, well, some hundreds of times.
Then how many are there?
How many? I don't know.
Quite so. You have not observed. And yet you have seen. That is just my point. Now, I know that there are 17 steps because I have both seen and observed. By the way, since you are interested in these little problems and since you are good enough to chronicle one or two of my trifling experiences, you may be interested in this. It came by the last post. Read it aloud.
There will call upon you tonight at 7:45 a gentleman who desires to consult you upon a matter of the very deepest moment. Your recent services to one of the royal houses of Europe have shown that you are one who may be trusted with matters which are of an importance which can hardly be exaggerated. This account of you we have from all quarters received. Be in your chamber, then, at that hour, and do not take it amiss if your visitor wear a mask. This is indeed a mystery. What do you imagine it means?
I have no data yet. It is a capital mistake to theorize before one has data. Insensibly, one begins to twist facts to suit theories instead of theories to suit facts. But the note itself, what do you deduce from that?
The man who wrote it was presumably well-to-do. Such paper could not be bought under 0.5 crown a packet. It is peculiarly strong and stiff.
Peculiar. That is the very word. It is not an English paper at all. Hold it up to the light.
Let me see. Ah, there's a large E with a small G and a P and a large G with a small T woven into the texture of the paper.
What do you make of that?
The name of the maker, no doubt, or his monogram, rather.
Not at all. The G with the small T stands for Gesellschaft, which is the German for company. It is a customary contraction, like our co. P, of course, stands for papier. Now for the EG. Let us glance at our Continental Gazetteer. Eglo, Eglonitz. Ah, here we are, Eglia. It is a German-speaking country in Bohemia, not far from Carlsbad. Remarkable as being the scene of the death of Wallenstein, and for its numerous glass factories and paper mills. Now, boy, what do you make of that?
The paper was made in Bohemia.
Precisely, and the man who wrote the note is a German. Do you note the peculiar construction of the sentence? This account of you we have from all quarters received. A Frenchman or a Russian could not have written that. It is the German who is so uncourteous to his verbs. This German, who writes upon Bohemian paper and prefers wearing a mask to showing his face. Getting to resolve all that. A pair of horses by the sound. Yes, a nice little carriage and a pair of beauties. 150 guineas apiece. There's money in this case, Watson, if there is nothing else.
I think I had better go, Holmes.
Doctor, stay where you are. I am lost. And this promises to be interesting. It would be a bit easy.
But your client...
Never mind him. I may want your help, and so may he. Here he comes. Sit down in that armchair, Doctor, and give us your best attention. Come in.
A man entered who could hardly have been less than 6 feet 6 inches in height, with the chest and limbs of a Hercules. His dress was rich, with a richness which would, in England, be looked upon as akin to bad taste. Heavy bands of astrakhan were slashed across the sleeves and the fronts of his double-breasted coat, while the deep blue cloak which was thrown over his shoulders was lined with flame-coloured silk and secured at the neck with a brooch of flaming beryl. Boots, which extended halfway up his calves and which were trimmed at the tops with a rich brown fur, completed the impression of barbaric opulence. He carried a broad-brimmed hat in his hand, while he wore, across the upper part of his face, a black vizard mask. From the lower part of his face, he seemed to be a man of strong character, with a thick, hanging lip, and a long, straight chin suggestive of resolution, pushed to the point of obstinacy.
You have my note.
Pray, take a seat. This is my friend and colleague, Dr. Watson, who is occasionally good enough to help me in my cases. Whom have I the honor to address?
You may address me as the Count von Kramm, a Bohemian nobleman. I understand that this gentleman, your friend, is a man of honor and discretion, whom I may trust with a matter of the most extreme importance. If not, I should much prefer to communicate with you alone.
Holmes, I think I'd better...
It is both or none. You may say before this gentleman anything you may say to me.
But then, I must begin by binding you both to absolute secrecy for 2 years.
At the end of that time, the matter will be of no importance. At present, it is not too much to say that it is of such weight it may have an influence upon European history.
I promise.
And I.
You will excuse this mask. The august person who employs me wishes his agent to be unknown to you. And I may confess at once that the title by which I have just called myself is not exactly my own.
I was aware of it.
The circumstances are of great delicacy, and every precaution has to be taken to quench what might grow to be an immense scandal and seriously compromise one of the reigning families of Europe. To speak plainly, the matter implicates the great house of Ormstein, hereditary kings of Bohemia.
I was also aware of that. If your majesty would condescend to state your case, I should be better able to advise you.
I am the king. Why should I attempt to conceal it?
Why, indeed. You are Wilhelm Gottreich Sigismund von Ormstein, Grand Duke of Castle Felstein and hereditary king of Bohemia.
But you can understand. You can understand that I am not accustomed to doing business in my own person. Yet the matter was so delicate that I could not confide it to an agent without putting myself in his power. I have come incognito from Prague for the purpose of consulting you.
Then pray consult.
Well, the facts are briefly these. Some 5 years ago, during a lengthy visit to Warsaw, I made the acquaintance of the well-known adventuress, Irene.
Kindly look her up in my index, Doctor.
Of course, Holmes.
Hardler. This must be it. Good Lord, Holmes has got some strange fish in there.
Find her, Watson?
Yes, here she is.
Let me see. Born in New Jersey in the year 1858. Contralto. La Scala. Prima Donna Imperial Opera of Warsaw. Yes. Retired from operatic stage. Living in London.
Quite so.
Your Majesty, as I understand, became entangled with this young person, wrote her some compromising letters, and is now desirous of getting those letters back.
Precisely so. But
was that a secret marriage?
None.
No legal papers or certificates?
None.
Then I fail to follow your Majesty. If this young person should produce her letters for blackmailing or other purposes, how is she to prove their authenticity?
There is the writing.
Oh, forgery.
My private notepad.
Stolen.
My own seal.
Imitated.
My photograph.
Bought.
We were both in the photograph.
Oh, dear. That is very bad. Your Majesty has indeed committed an indiscretion.
I was mad. Insane.
You have compromised yourself seriously.
I was only crown prince then. I was young. I am but 30 now.
It must be recovered.
We have tried and failed.
Your Majesty must pay. It must be bought.
She will not sell.
Stolen, then.
5 attempts have been made. 2 burglars in my pay ransacked her house. Once we diverted her luggage when she traveled. 2 she has been waylaid. There has been no result.
No sign of it?
Absolutely none.
You have quite a pretty problem.
But a very serious one to me.
Very, indeed. And what does she propose to do with the photograph?
To ruin me.
But how?
I'm about to be married.
So I have heard.
To Claudel Lotham von Saxe-Meiningen, second daughter of the King of Scandinavia. You may know the strict principles of that family. She is herself the very soul of delicacy. A shadow of doubt as to my conduct would bring the matter to an end.
And Irena Adler?
Threatens to send them the photograph. And she will do it. I know that she will do it. You do not know her. But she has a soul of steel. She has the face of the most beautiful of women and the mind of the most resolute of men. Rather than I should marry another woman, there are no lengths to which she would not go. None.
You are sure that she has not sent it yet?
I am sure.
And why?
Because she has said that she would send it on the day when the betrothal was publicly proclaimed. and that will be next Monday.
Oh, well, we have 3 days yet. That is very fortunate, as I have one or two matters of importance to look into just at the moment. Your Majesty will, of course, stay in London for the present.
Certainly. You will find me at the Langham under the name of Count von Kramp.
And then I shall let you know how we progress.
Pray do so. I shall be all anxiety.
Then, as to money?
You have carte blanche.
Absolutely.
I tell you that I would give one of the provinces of my kingdom to have that photograph.
And for present expenses?
There are £300 in gold and 700 in notes.
And Mademoiselle's address?
Bryony Lodge, Serpentine Avenue, St. John's Wood.
And one other question. Was the photograph in a case?
It was.
Then, good night.
Mr. Holmes, I am in your debt. Good night.
And good night, Watson.
Eh? Oh, yes. I must be getting on. My wife, you know.
If you'll be good enough to call tomorrow afternoon at 3 o'clock, I should be glad to chat this little matter over with you.
At 3 o'clock precisely, I was at Baker Street, but Holmes had not yet returned. The landlady informed me that he'd left the house shortly after 8 o'clock in the morning. I sat down beside the fire, with the intention of awaiting him, however long he might be. I was already deeply interested in his inquiry, for, though it was surrounded by none of the grim and strange features which were associated with the study in scarlet, which I have already recorded, still the nature of the case and the exalted station of his client gave it a character of its own. Indeed, apart from the nature of the investigation which my friend had on hand, there was something in his masterly grasp of the situation and his keen, incisive reasoning which made it a pleasure to me to study his system of work and to follow the quick, subtle methods by which he disentangled the most inextricable mysteries. So accustomed was I to his invariable success that the very possibility of his failing had ceased to enter into my head. I waited some time. Suddenly, the door burst open.
Oh, you can't just come in. Oh, of course. Home.
I won't give you a moment, Watson. Just need to get out of these stinking vestments. There. Holmes is himself again.
What is it?
It's quite too funny. I'm sure you could never guess how I employed my morning or what I ended by doing.
I can't imagine. I suppose that you've been watching the habits and perhaps the house of Miss Irene Hartler.
Quite so. But the sequel was rather unusual. I left the house a little after 8 o'clock this morning in the character of a groom out of work. There is a wonderful sympathy and freemasonry among horsey men. Be one of them and you will know all there is to know. I soon found Bryony Lodge. It is a bijou villa with a garden at the back, but built right up to the road. 2 stories, chub block to the door, large sitting room on the right side, well furnished, with long windows almost to the floor, and those are preposterous English window fasteners which a child could open. It is as secure as a sieve. I walked round it and examined it closely from every point of view. I then lounged down the street and found, as I expected, that there was a mews running down one wall of the garden. I helped a couple of stable lads rub down their horses and received in exchange a glass of gin, 2 fills of shag tobacco, and as much information as I could desire about Miss Adler.
Anne?
She has turned all the men's heads. She is the daintiest thing under a bonnet on this planet. So, say the Serpentine Mews, to a man. But she only has one male visitor. He is dark, handsome, and dashing. One Mr. Godfrey Norton of the Inner Temple, a lawyer. That sounded ominous. What was the relation between them? Was she his client, his friend, or his mistress? If his client, she had probably transferred the photograph to his keeping. On this issue depended whether I should continue my work at Briony Lodge or turn my attention to the gentleman's chambers in the temple. It was a delicate point. I was still balancing the matter in my mind when a hansom cab drove up to Briony Lodge.
Sherlock Holmes and Dr. Watson match wits with the woman on the next and concluding episode of A Scandal in Bohemia. Edward Petherbridge was Sherlock Holmes, with David Peart as Dr. John H. Watson and John Elmes as the King of Bohemia. The story was adapted for radio by Richard Shannon, with original music performed by Robert Gibbs and Michiku Ueno. I'm Steve Zakar. Support for this program is provided by National Public Radio member stations and the NPR Arts and Performance Fund. Contributors include the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation and Bramley Pacific, master developer of Oakland, California's City Center office development. This is NPR National Public Radio. National Public Radio, in association with Independent Radio Drama Productions, presents one of the cases of Sherlock Holmes, with Edward Petherbridge as Sherlock Holmes and David Peart as Dr. John H. Watson. This is episode 2 of A Scandal in Bohemia. Arthur Conan Doyle drew from real-life experiences whenever possible while creating the plots for the Sherlock Holmes stories. He spent 6 months in Vienna in 1891, and while there, soaked up all the human interest stories he could find. There was scandal in the air that cold winter, and the papers were filled with tragic tales of suicides and illicit affairs. The gossip pages of Viennese papers just sizzled with coverage of Ludmilla Hubel, a gifted singer and actress who had become involved with an heir to the Austrian throne. Compromising photographs showing her with the royal consort had been splashed all over the press. In real life, the singer and her lover were eventually married, but forced by the scandal to leave Viennese society. The couple bought a yacht and sailed to South America, never to be seen again. Conan Doyle's finish to this tale is substantially different, as we'll soon find out. Here's the story up to this point. Watson has married and begun his own medical practice. Chance leads him past 221B Baker Street, and he drops in on Holmes just in time to become involved in a case. A mysterious aristocrat comes calling. He is a large man who has chosen to hide his true identity behind a mask. But he has hardly begun to tell his story when Holmes correctly identifies him as the King of Bohemia, who has traveled all the way from Prague for this consultation. 5 years earlier, the king made the acquaintance of a well-known adventuress named Irene Adler. Adler was an American, a singer, and an actress. But she was not of royal stature, and when the time came for the king to marry, he had to select from among his own kind and became engaged to the daughter of the king of Scandinavia. Then Irene Adler threatened to make public their relationship. Holmes asked the king what evidence Adler has to support her claim. There is writing, the king says. Forgery, replies Holmes. My private notepaper. Stolen. My own seal. Imitated. But there was also a photograph of the two together. That is very bad, Holmes tells the king. Your Majesty has indeed committed an indiscretion. 5 attempts have been made to steal the compromising photograph. All 5 have failed. In 3 days, the king's betrothal will be publicly announced, at which time Irene Adler will release the photograph to the press. The king gives Holmes a blank check to obtain the picture for him. Holmes takes to disguise in order to scout Irene Adler's London house, Bryony Lodge. He asks Watson to return next evening for a progress report. Holmes has not yet returned when Watson arrives, so he waits. Soon Holmes appears. He has transformed himself into a drunken-looking groom, ill-kept and side-whiskered, with an inflamed face and disreputable clothes. Thus disguised, he mingled with the servants at Bryony Lodge to pick up gossip about Irene Adler. She is the daintiest thing under a bonnet on this planet, Holmes tells Watson. Continuing his story, Holmes explains how he was loitering just outside Bryony Lodge when a hansom cab rattled up to the front door. That's where we pick up the action in the second and concluding episode of A Scandal in Bohemia.
Wait here.
Mr. Godfrey Norton, remarkably handsome, dark, aquiline, and moustached. It must be him. I wonder what he's up to. Evidently in a hurry. Ah, there he is in the sitting room. What's he doing now? Pacing up and down, waving his arms. Clearly in some agitation. Gone. Nope, the door's opening.
Drive like the devil, cabbie. First to Gross and Hankey's in Regent Street, and then to the Church of St. Monica in the Edgware Road. Half a guinea if you do it in 20 minutes.
Ooh, right, I'll go.
St. Monica's in the Edgware Road. What the devil can he want there? Ah, what's happening? It's Miss Adler. What a vision. What a lovely woman.
The Church of St. Monica, and half a sovereign if you reach it in 20 minutes.
Cabby! Cabby! Yes. Cabby! The Church of St. Monica, and half a sovereign if you reach it in 20 minutes.
Eh?
Half a sovereign now. Hurry up!
Half a sovereign? You don't look as if you've got half a sixpence that clear off.
Here is the money. Now, drive!
Oh, we'll rout you all, Saxon. Speed up there.
Oh, for God's sake, man.
Oh, Godfrey.
Ah, thank God. There is someone. I say, yes, you'll do. Come.
Come.
Yes, thank you.
Ah, now, we may proceed. Will you, good sir, act as witness to the marriage of these two young people?
Well, I don't know.
There's a sovereign for your trouble.
Now, we can proceed. Do you know of any reason whatsoever wherefore Mr. Godfrey Norton, bachelor, may not take Miss Irene Adler, spinster of this parish, to be his lawful wedded wife?
Can't say as I do.
Fascinating, Holmes. And what happened then?
I got my sovereign. I intend to wear it on my watch chain in memory of the occasion.
Yes, but what
they were married, and then they rushed out of the church and drove off in different directions. and I went off to make my own arrangements.
Which are?
Some cold beef and a glass of beer. I have been too busy to think of food, and I am likely to be busier still this evening. I hope Mrs. Turner will have something on the go. By the way, Doctor, I shall want your cooperation.
I shall be delighted.
You don't mind breaking the law?
Not in the least.
Nor running the chance of arrest?
Not in a good cause.
Oh, the cause is excellent.
Then I am your man.
I was sure that I might rely on you.
But what is it you wish me to do?
Ah, Mrs. Turner, just be so good as to put the tray down there. What a spread, and a glass of the best brown ale.
There you are, Mr. Holmes. Will you be wanting anything, Dr. Watson?
No, thank you, Mrs. Turner. I ate at 1 o'clock.
Yes, regular hours.
Thank you, Mrs. Turner. And that will be all.
I'll collect the tray later, Mr. Holmes.
Now, Watson, we must discuss it while I eat, for I have not much time. It is nearly 5 now. In 2 hours, we must be on the scene of the action. Miss Irene, or Madame, rather, returns from her drive at 7. We must be at Briony Lodge to meet her.
And what then?
You must leave that to me. I have already arranged what is to occur. There is only one point on which I must insist. You must not interfere, come what may. You understand?
I am to be neutral.
Mm-hmm. To do nothing whatever. There will probably be some unpleasantness. Do not join it. It will end in my being conveyed into the house. 4 or 5 minutes afterwards, the sitting room window will open. You are to station yourself close to that open window.
Yes.
You are to watch me, for I will be visible to you.
Yes.
And then, when I raise my hand, so, you will throw into the room what I give to you to throw. And will at the same time raise the cry of fire. You quite follow me?
Entirely.
It's nothing very formidable. Here. It is an ordinary plumber's smoke rocket, fitted with a cap at either end to make it self-lighting. Your task is confined to that. When you raise your cry of fire, it will be taken up by quite a number of people. You may then walk to the end of the street, and I will rejoin you in 10 minutes. I hope I have made myself clear.
I am to remain neutral, to get near the window, to watch you, and at the signal to throw in this object, then to raise the cry of fire, and to await you at the corner of the street.
Precisely.
Then you may entirely rely on me.
That is excellent. I think perhaps it is almost time to prepare
the new role I have to play. Holmes, the stage lost a fine actor when you became a specialist in crime.
Yeah.
Are you all right, Holmes?
This damn stiff collar.
Need a hand.
I'm to all, my dear chap.
Good grief. The Reverend Sherlock Holmes.
My good fellow, we really must be getting along. We have our duties to perform. We must not be tardy.
It was 6:15 when we left Baker Street, and it still wanted 10 minutes to the hour when we found ourselves in Serpentine Avenue. It was already dusk, and the lamps were just being lighted. We paced up and down in front of Briony Lodge, waiting for the coming of its occupant. The lamplight was thin and pallid and barely penetrated the growing pall of fog that billowed around Briony Lodge. The house was just as I had pictured it from Sherlock Holmes' succinct description.
Fog and damp would play havoc in my chest. We've been waiting an hour already. I wonder how much longer. That's strange. Where did this lot spring from? A scissors grinder with his wheel, a couple of soldiers making eyes at a nurse girl, and a whole crowd of young men with cigars. Perhaps this neighborhood is a lot less exclusive than Holmes led me to believe.
You see, Watson.
What, Holmes?
The marriage rather simplifies the matter. The photograph becomes a double-edged weapon now. The chances are that you will be as averse to its being seen by Mr. Godfrey Norton as our client is to its coming to the eyes of his princess. Now, the question is, where are we to find the photograph?
Where indeed?
It is most unlikely that she carries it about her. It is in a wooden case. too large for easy concealment about a woman's dress. She knows that the king is capable of having her waylaid and searched. Two attempts of that sort have already been made. We may take it, then, that she does not carry it about with her.
Where, then?
Her banker or her lawyer. That is that double possibility, but I'm inclined to think neither. Women are naturally secretive, and they like to do their own secreting. Besides, remember that she had resolved to use it within a few days. It must be where she can lay her hands upon it. It must be in her own house.
But it has twice been burgled.
They did not know how to look.
But how will you look?
I will not look.
What then?
I will get her to show me.
She will refuse.
She will not be able to. But I hear the rumble of wheels. It is her carriage. Now, carry out my orders to the letter.
Gone before you can get to the hospital.
He's a brave fellow. He'd have had the lady's purse and watch if it hadn't been for him. There were a gang and a rough one too. He's breathing now.
He can't lie in the street. May we bring him in, ma'am?
Oh, surely. Bring him into the sitting room. There's a comfortable sofa. This way, please.
Right there. Come on.
My goodness, what the devil is Holmes playing at? I hope he's not badly hurt. Now, I must get over to the window. Ah, they've lit the lamps. Oh, Lord, I hope they don't close the curtains. Ah, no, I can see him. There he is, lying on the couch. Ah, and there's the beautiful Elaine. Such radiance. And we are out to deceive such an angel. Look how she's ministering to Holmes. How can we do this? I'm ashamed. Holmes, I hope this is all for the good. I won't let you down. I cannot. This prank won't injure her, merely prevent her injuring another. I will do it. Now, where'd I put the damn thing? Here it is. I'll just take it out of my ulster. There. He's raised his hand. And there, the maid is opening the window. Right. Fire!
False alarm!
That's Holmes. Oh, what the devil's he up to? Now he's calming things down. Right, I must get out of here and wait for Holmes at the corner of the street.
You did it very nicely, Doctor.
Ah, thank God, Holmes.
Nothing could have been better.
You have the photograph.
I know where it is.
And how did you find out?
She showed me, as I told you she would.
I am still in the dark.
I do not wish to make a mystery. The matter was perfectly simple. You, of course, saw that everyone in the street was an accomplice. They were all engaged for the evening.
Ah, yes, of course. I guessed as much.
Then, when the row broke out, I had a little moist red paint in the palm of my hand. I rushed forward, fell down, clapped my hand to my face, and became a piteous spectacle. It is an old trick.
Yes, of course.
Then they carried me in. She was bound to have me in. What else could she do? And into her sitting room, which was the very room I suspected. They lay me on a couch. I motioned for air. They were compelled to open the window. And you had your chance.
How did that help you?
It was all important. When a woman thinks her house is on fire, her instinct is at once to rush to the thing which she values most. It is a perfectly overpowering impulse, and I have more than once taken advantage of it. In the case of the Darlington substitution scandal, it was of use to me, and also in the Arnsford Castle business. A married woman grabs at her baby, and an unmarried one reaches for her jewel box. Now, it is clear to me that Our Lady of today had nothing in the house more precious to her than the photograph that compromises the King of Bohemia. She would rush to secure it. The alarm of the fire was admirably done. The smoke and the shouting were enough to shake nerves of steel. She responded beautifully. The photograph is in a recess behind a sliding panel just above the right bell pull.
She was there in an instant, and I caught a glimpse of it as she half drew it out. When I cried out that it was a false alarm, she replaced it, glanced at the rocket, rushed from the room, and I have not seen her since. I rose and, making my excuses, escaped from the house. I hesitated whether to secure the photograph at once, but the coachman had come in, and as he was watching me narrowly, it seemed safer to wait. A little over-precipitance may ruin all.
And now?
Our quest is practically finished. I shall call with the king tomorrow, and with you, if you care to come with us. We will be shown into the sitting room to wait for the lady.
And when will you call?
At 8 in the morning. She will not be up, so we shall have a clear field. Ah, here we are. Do you have a key, Watson?
My dear Holmes, I no longer live here.
Ah, of course. I shall ring for Mrs. Turner. We have an early start. Will you stay the night?
Of course.
Good.
Good night, Mr. Sherlock Holmes.
Good night. I've heard that voice before. Now, I wonder who the deuce that could have been.
More toast, Watson?
No, thank you, Holmes. Just a drop more coffee.
You have really got it.
Not yet.
But you have hopes.
I have hopes.
Then come. I am all impatience to be gone.
Oh, we must have a cab.
My carriage is waiting.
Well, that will simplify matters.
Irene Adler is married.
Married? When?
Yesterday.
But to who?
To an English lawyer called Norton.
But she could not love him.
I'm in hopes that she does.
Why in hopes?
Because it would spare your majesty all fear of future annoyance. If the lady loves her husband, she does not love your majesty. If she does not love your majesty, then there is no reason why she should interfere with your majesty's marriage to the princess.
This is true. And yet... I wish she had been on my own station. What a queen she would
have. Ah, we have arrived.
I say, Holmes, the door's open. And who's that old woman?
Oh, I dare say we shall find out shortly.
Mr. Sherlock Holmes, I believe.
I am Holmes.
Indeed. My mistress told me that you were likely to call.
Indeed?
She left this morning with her husband by the 5:15 train from Charing Cross for the continent.
What? Do you mean that she has left England?
Never to return.
And the photograph? Oh! All is lost.
We shall see.
Good Lord, what a mess. Books, drawers, everything ransacked before they took flight.
Holmes? Holmes, what are you doing?
It is here, Watson. I saw it. This is where. Well, there is a photograph. But it is not the one that we are after. And a letter. It is addressed to me.
My dear Sherlock Holmes, you really did it very well. You took me in completely. Until after the alarm of fire, I had not a suspicion. But then, when I found how I had betrayed myself, I began to think. I had been warned against you months ago.
I had been told that if the king employed an agent, it would certainly be you. And your address had been given me. Yet with all this, you made me reveal what you wanted to know. Even after I became suspicious, I found it hard to think evil of such a dear, kind old clergyman. But, you know, I have been trained as an actress myself. Male costume is nothing new to me. I often take advantage of the freedom which it gives. I sent John, the coachman, to watch you, ran upstairs, got into my walking clothes, as I call them, and came down just as you departed. Well, I followed you to your door and so made sure that I was really an object of interest to the celebrated Mr. Sherlock Holmes. Then I rather imprudently wished you good night and started for the temple to see my husband. We both thought the best resource was flight when pursued by so formidable an antagonist, so you will find the nest empty when you call tomorrow. As to the photograph, your client may rest in peace.
I love and am loved by a better man than he. The king may do what he will without hindrance from one whom he has cruelly wronged. I keep it only to safeguard myself and to preserve a weapon which will always secure me from any steps which he might take in the future. I leave a photograph which he might care to possess, and I remain, dear Mr. Sherlock Holmes, very truly yours, Irene Norton, nay, Adler.
What a woman. Oh, what a woman. Did I not tell you how quick and resolute she was? Would she not have made an admirable queen? Is it not a pity she was not on my level?
But from what I have seen in the lady, she seems indeed to be on a very different level to your majesty. I am sorry that I have not been able to bring your majesty's business to a more successful conclusion.
On the contrary, my dear sir. Nothing could be more successful. I know that her word is inviolate. The photograph is now as safe as if it were in the fire.
I am glad to hear your majesty say so.
I am immensely indebted to you. Pray tell me in what way I can reward you. This ring?
Your majesty has something which I should value even more highly.
You have but to name it.
This photograph.
Irene's photograph. Sir, if you wish it.
I thank you, majesty. Then there is no more to be done in the matter. I have the honor to wish you a very good morning.
Mr. Holmes.
Wait a moment. I can hardly keep up.
No, my dear Watson, it is I who could not keep up. But I was left very far behind the game.
And that was how a great scandal threatened to affect the kingdom of Bohemia, and how the best plans of Mr. Sherlock Holmes were beaten by a woman's wit. He used to make merry over the cleverness of women, but I have not heard him do it of late. And when he speaks of Irene Adler, or when he refers to her photograph, it is always under the honorable title of The Woman.
Edward Petherbridge was Sherlock Holmes, with David Peart as Dr. John H. Watson. Kate Hamer was Irene Adler, Richard Shannon was Godfrey Norton, and John Elmes was the King of Bohemia. The story was adapted for radio by Richard Shannon, with music performed by Robert Gibbs and Michiko Ueno. I'm Steve Zakar. Support for this program is provided by National Public Radio member stations and the NPR Arts and Performance Fund. Contributors include the Chrysler Corporation Fund and the Bell Atlantic Charitable Foundation. Sherlock Holmes will be back in The Adventure of the Speckled Band. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Countertenor and ensemble director Drew Campion is the guest this week on Millennium of Music. He's got a new recording with his ensemble 5-1, and we'll hear some of it. Music of Campion, Morley, Holborn, Palestrina, and many more tonight on Millennium of Music. That's tonight at 8 o'clock here on 88.9 FM, WFSU-FM, Tallahassee.